execution is obviously critical. When we start off in our careers, you know, we have to be very good at executing. And then over time, we become better at tactics and hopefully at some point become really good with strategy. But to be able to function in this very cross-functional way and be able to sort of go across this, especially in a startup environment, I think all three things are required. So again, it's sort of more breadth versus depth. You're a great, phenomenal strategic thinker. You have a role in the startup world, but there is a limitation to what you'd be able to do if you can't execute and you can't come up with tactics. Similarly, you're great. You're a machine. You're a beast in execution, but you don't have strategic depth or you don't have tactical depth. You will struggle. So I think which is where, as PMs, you know, having all these three abilities is great.
Welcome to Prime Venture Partners Podcast, a podcast for entrepreneurs looking to build and grow their startups. Learn about uncommon strategies and common traps from makers and doers of startup ecosystem.
Welcome to the Prime Venture Partners Podcast. I'm your host, Amit Somani, and I am delighted to have with us again in a different format, Anshumani Rudra, a friend, a product tinkerer, and the product lead for Google Pay globally. Welcome to the show, Anshumani.
Good to be here, Amit. Really good to be here.
So Anshumani, you had a lot of varied careers, including sort of landing up at Google, kind of the mother of them all. And I used to be at Google many years ago. So we'll talk about Google in a second. But maybe you can take our listeners through your early journey from, you know, the Zynga days to QMath and so forth in terms of your own evolution as a product manager, product designer, product strategist.
Sure, absolutely. So at Zynga, I started out as a game designer. So I was the first game designer at Zynga India, and you know, was part of the core team which originally sort of set around to sort of building out Zynga India, the first studio of Zynga outside the US, right? And we did phenomenally well. It grew incredibly fast, and you know, I spent a lot of time in the US working with PMs and designers there. And I think sort of the product design bug sort of bit me then. You know, this was Zynga in its early days. Pre-IPO, Zynga was a phenomenal place to work. It still is. It still continues to do phenomenally well. But back then, just the concentration of PMs and game designers was amazing. And I think that started this journey for me, which I continued by running my own game studio, Tiny Mogul Games, which eventually got acquired by Hike. It was a sister company to Hike. And then I sort of reached a decision point where I was like, okay, I've spent enough time in games. Let me see if I can sort of take the lessons from, and at this point, officially, I'd never held the product manager title. I had been a game designer and then a general manager or sort of a studio head, right? But my thesis was that there are a whole bunch of learnings from the world of game design and from the world of gaming, which can be applied to what I call the roti kapda makan products, right? Like regular everyday use products, which millions of people use. So I found the thing which was diametrically opposite to entertainment, which in my head seemed like healthcare and education. So I went to Practo, right, to see if that would make sense. And great experience. So again, so sort of spent time at Practo running sort of the central product org there, both the consumer side products as well as the doctor facing products. Then went to my first love, which is education. I come from a family of educators, so sort of education runs fairly deep in the family. So went to QMath to head product there, build out a team. Very different business model, very different scale. You know, when you're in the world of games, you know, there are millions and millions of users who play your games. And here, you know, we were doing a very B2B2C model. You know, thousands of teachers teaching tens of thousands of students. So very, very different model, very different scale and a very different set of problems to be solved. And after that, I worked at Hotstar, which now is Disney plus Hotstar. So I was there for a very long time, led sports, social and gaming verticals at Hotstar and sort of was responsible for, our streaming of IPL and World Cup and a bunch of other things. So, you know, Hotstar is the home for cricket in India. So did a bunch of that. Then very recently, it's been 9 months and I've been at Google I thought everyone and their grandmother was working in fintech. So I thought, hey, about time I also went and tried out fintech. I mean, jokes aside, though, it was also sort of the fact that, you know, Google is a generational company, and part of me felt that, hey, someday I'm going to be 60 and I'd look back at my career and say, damn, I didn't work at Google. So let me, you know, now seems to be a good time to go work at Google. And Google Pay is definitely like a, having spent so much time at startups, both early stage, mid stage and late stage, Google Pay seemed like a startup within Google, and it is a startup within Google, definitely has the culture. So, which is how I ended up there.
Fantastic. Lots of different threads to follow up on. Let me break it down into two. One is your own journey going from being a game designer to a general manager to a product manager to running your own studio as an entrepreneur and so forth. So, you know, in what are the skills that you've learned that sort of, you know, helped you across, right? And in terms of cross-pollination, to the extent that if somebody was a general manager today or a manager or an engineer wanting to go the other route, become a game designer or become a this, you know, how versatile, you know, is that sort of path of learning? That is one thread. And the other thread, maybe I'll pause here, but is really the multiple different verticals you worked in, right? Mm-hmm. So let's do that later.
Yeah. On the first one, I think, so I feel like a lot of product building is, you know, it requires this sort of cross-pollination where, you know, being a jack of all trades and master of none, I think it's an overabused term. But if you really think about it, what it requires is breadth more than depth in a lot of areas. I think you need depth in one or two areas, but you need a lot more breadth. Because a part of being a product builder, a part of being a product manager, a successful product manager at least, is being able to work with other people. So I think one of the big things there is that, do you have a deep appreciation for what engineers do on a day in and day out basis? What do you know, designers do on a day in and day out basis? The kind of work that marketeers do and you know, folks on partnerships and business development do. And I think that bit of just sort of being the glue that holds the team together and being able to work in this cross-functional way, I think it requires you to have enough breadth that when you sit in a room with people very different from you, who do a very different function from you, are you able to listen, absorb, make sense of what they are telling you, and then contribute in a positive way? And I think, to me, I think when people talk about a breadth of skills, I think to me, that is sort of the theme, the motif, so to say, which runs across all these things that, you know, are you able to go and contribute within these different rules? I never diminish the sort of the ability for people to be subject matter experts in a particular domain or sort of just have insane depth, because without those people, you don't get things built, right? But those are people you bank on, right? So like, you know, the 10X engineer or sort of those phenomenal designers and engineers, you need them to build great products. But there is a great utility for people who can just go across different functions and again sort of do all the three levels, right, of this job function, you know. And I sort of have this, you know, the Simon Sinek start with the why framework always sort of seems very applicable to me when it comes to product manager's job, right, which is the why, how, and what. Why are we doing what we are doing? And why would people care if we did this? Why would our users care if we did this? And to me, that's actually strategy. So that's the first layer. Why build this? Why do this? Why should I be doing this? Why should we collectively be building this, right? And that sort of is the strategic part of any function, but I think very critical for product managers. The second bit is, how should we build this? How should we go about solving this problem, which is very clearly the domain of tactics. And then there's the bottom layer, which is what? What should we be doing, right? What should be the steps that we take? And I think that's very clearly in the realm of execution. Now, if we take a sort of a diagonal line through this or create a wedge through this, like a pyramidical wedge, right? Execution is obviously critical. When we start off in our careers, you know, we have to be very good at executing. And then over time, we become better at tactics and hopefully at some point become really good with strategy. But to be able to function in this very cross-functional way and be able to sort of go across this, especially in a startup environment, I think all three things are required. So again, it's sort of more breadth versus depth. You're a great, phenomenal strategic thinker, you have a role in the startup world, but there is a limitation to what you'd be able to do if you can't execute and you can't come up with tactics. Similarly, you're great. You're a machine. You're a beast in execution, but you don't have strategic depth or you don't have tactical depth. You will struggle. So I think which is where as PMs, you know, having all these three abilities is great. So again, it's more of breadth as opposed to sort of depth.
Yeah, I'm also a big fan of this work, right? Just like Simon Sinek, of David Epstein, right? How generalists succeed in a specialized world.
Absolutely.
And it's really, you know, multidisciplinary thinking and applying it in various ways. To make it more practical to many of our listeners who might be sort of early stage entrepreneurs, if you are going and hiring product managers or product strategists or designers, you obviously are not going to get everything in every person, right? And you're also typically, when you're starting out your company, you don't have the war chest that the Google has to hire Anshuman Irotra, right? So how would you, you know, would you prioritize in the early days of the company, like think 0 to 1, 1 to 10 stages, certain skill sets over the others in terms of the, you know, the why, the how, and the what?
I think it has to be a very deeper analysis of who you are. So if I was the founder of this company, right, and I had say two co-founders, if between the three of us, I knew what our skill sets were very, very clearly, then I need to hire people who complement those skill sets and maybe cover the skill sets which are not present, right? So if you are a product co-founder, right, like if I was the co-founder, I wouldn't worry too much about, at least in the early days, the strategic and tactical side of things. I would get great designers on board who have sort of a very good sense of UX thinking, but I would get really good executors on board, right? So I would go after young people who can just be, you know, beasts when it comes to execution, right? And put in the hard work. And it's not necessarily work 16 hours a day, but when they work in that focused 8-10 hours, they can move mountains, right? Similarly, if one of the co-founders is a very strong sort of CTO himself or herself, then go hire engineers who are sort of going to help in sort of execution. But if you don't have an engineering counterpart, then I think forget the job title, but essentially hiring an architect, right, is job number one. Get someone in who can build the shape of the vision that you have, who can actually translate sort of what you want to build into this sort of framework, saying, hey, these are the APIs we'll build. This is the structure that we'll build. This is the platform that we'll build. And, you know, these are the pieces that we'll build. And then they can go and work either with external engineers or build sort of a small team of front-end and back-end and sort of full-stack engineers within their house, right? Again, if you're a founder and design comes naturally to you and good user experience, forget like being able to use Figma, but if you have a good sense of user experience, then you go hire designers who can help translate your vision into reality. But if you don't have a strong designer or somebody with a very strong aesthetic sensibility and user experience sensibility in your founding team, go hire that person, right? So I think it's, for me, it's always been that. How do you complement? So the reverse is also true. When I've looked at joining early stage startups, I always look, is there a vacuum? Is there a place to fill? Right. If I look at the founding team and I say, you know what, you already cover three of the five things that I bring to this table, I'm not really required. If I cover a majority of the things which they lack, then I know that I can go and make a real difference. Right. So that reverse mapping is also true. So, I mean, whether it's a founder mapping that, hey, in my core team, in my first set of people that I'll hire, what are the skill sets I want? It's very dependent on the skill sets you don't have. But sometimes the mistake people make is product founders, for example, might actually be spending a lot of time fundraising and doing everything else that being a CEO has, you know, entails, and might not be able to spend that kind of time on building the product. In that case, go hire a product builder. Go hire someone who can do a lot of the 0 to 1 thinking for you.
Right. No, lots of interesting insights there. Going to the other dimension, without going into the specifics of each company, but what have you learned from working across domains, right? Whether it was sports and cricket with Hotstar or QMath and EdTech or healthcare and Facto and so forth. What are, again, things that are transferable in terms of your own learnings, as well as perhaps if I can take the Indian consumer lens, how has the Indian consumer evolved? So even though you've been changing sectors, but the consumer has also been evolving, right? So.
Absolutely. I'll give you a great example of this, right? Like when you're at Pacto, we are trying to build a network, a social network for doctors. It was one of the projects I worked on in my early days at Pacto.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a classic, you know, like a profile page for doctors. And, you know, we already had a lot of information about doctors. So we onboarded about, you know, 40, 50 doctors in this beta that we were running. And we had this beautiful profile page. And we realized no doctor was making any edits to this page. So, you know, their name, qualification, age, you know, colleges that they had gone to, et cetera. And they weren't making changes, even though when obviously there were errors. In fact, in a few places, I introduced errors just to see if the doctor would go change like the name of the college that they had gone to. But doctors weren't. So we called up a doctor and I said, sir, what's happening? Right? Like, why are you not going and editing? And his question was, how do I edit? And I'm like, that pencil icon is right there next to your name, next to your qualification. And in Hindi, he said, mujhe sapna aayega ki that is what I have to do to sort of edit this. And that is, for me, that was such a massive wake-up call that, you know, doctors are not on LinkedIn. Doctors are not on Facebook. And this was not an old doctor. This was a 40-year-old, right? But the reality, and this is of course, 6 years back, 2015. But the fact is that doctors are, you know, they use their phone, they use email effectively, and they use, you know, WhatsApp very effectively. And there are certain tools of their work, you know, technology-driven tools that they use. But like you or I, they are not sitting on social media, right? They are not on Twitter. They are, so building a profile for themselves is not obvious to them. And the fact that this deeply ingrained design pattern that a pencil icon means edit, right, is not clear to them. It's not obvious to them, right? So this was one big learning. And I went and sat with my designer who cried tears of sort of blood that, you know, you're going to make me change it to a label saying, click here to add your, to edit your name, click here to edit your qualification. But it worked. We had 90% plus conversion on that page in terms of people, you know, editing their profile. But if I flip that across, right? So the evolution though is that now we are in a world where, so, you know, one could say, okay, you know, standard universal design patterns don't work in India. That could have been the bad takeaway from that example. But the truth is, the Indian user is evolving far faster than our product managers and designers are evolving. So the fact, like, one of my favorite examples on ShareChat is that because people use material created on ShareChat for sharing, they changed that three-dot button, which is the share icon on Android, to a WhatsApp icon because they knew that what people will be using is WhatsApp for sharing, right? Now, the fact that that is the default way of sharing and that WhatsApp is share is so easily understood, right? But then there is power usage which is happening. My mother showed me, my mother who's in her 60s showed me that on, I used to get a message on WhatsApp, I would hard press the message, then get into reply mode and type a reply. And she's like, why do you do that? You can just swipe right on any message and it automatically goes into reply mode. And I had one of those moments where my mind was blown that my mother, who is, you know, she's tech savvy, sure, but like she knows this design pattern and I don't. And I'm the one who actually builds these products, right? So I think one of the big things that has happened is that the most popular products in the ecosystem quickly become the lingua franca of design. So users understand these design patterns very inherently because of WhatsApp, because of Facebook, because of the rise of TikTok back in the day and sort of now with Reels and everything else, right? Data is so cheap in India that video is the default way in which we now sort of consume content, right? Like we skipped all other things. We skipped audio, we skipped a bunch of things and we directly jumped to video and became the largest consumers of video in the world, right? So with things like this, we have to keep pace with our users, not the other way around. I often earlier used to make this mistake that, you know, design would be ahead of users and users have to play catch up, which is just a really bad way of thinking about it, because your users should not be playing catch up with you. You should be building for your users. But now it's the other extreme where I think our users are far ahead of us, right? Are far ahead of the people building in this market. So when we say we are building for Bharat or you're building for the next 100 million users, and I feel like, man, the people who are building have no idea where the next 100 million people have gone. They've gone to a different place. They're far ahead. They use the kind of products we don't use. So their design thinking and design patterns have evolved. We have to catch it.
Let me ask you a specific question on that, right? Mm. So if you were doing a Pacto-like thing today, which you are in some sense, right? Because you're doing Google Pay and tomorrow you'll do something else and so forth. And you wanted to catch up with the current design lingua franca of where the state of the art is, right? Like building for Bharat. What is a practical way in which you would go and figure that out before you start designing anything? Saying, let me understand that people understand the share button, or people understand the edit button, or the pencil, or the moral equivalent.
We have to learn from people who have been doing this for the last 80, 90 years in India, which is everyone who's ever worked in FMCG. You know, the Unilevers of India, the ITCs of India were very big on user research and market research, all right? Every one of our brethren who work in, you know, the big four consulting companies or who have ever worked in the world of FMCG. And I think this is very weird. As you look at mid-stage and late-stage startups, you realize that a lot of the business leadership actually comes from old school companies. You know, a lot of folks who have worked in Hindustan Lever, et cetera, or Pepsi or Coke and things like that are actually leaders at larger companies. But early stage companies seem to think that we have nothing to learn from old school companies. And to me, that's a big fundamental problem, because they were very good at market research. They were very good at going and figuring out insights from the users by actually going sitting with their users and think. The fact that, I know shampoo sachet is such a, you know, over-abused example of like good product thinking, but it is great product thinking. They realize that you can't sell full shampoo bottles at 25 bucks a pop to people. You have to sell it at 1 rupee a pop in sachets, right? That's great user insight. What is the equivalent of that user insight in the tech product world, right? So there is no shortcut, but the only way to do this is actually go and, you know, talk to the people who are your potential users or who are your existing users, right? Like, go figure out how usage happens. Go figure out why only 20% women are your users. And you'd realize, because only 20% of them own their own phones, they still use their brother's phone or their husband's phone during the day, or their kid's phone, for crying out loud, during the day when the kid is away in school. So ownership of phones is restricted to 4 hours or 5 hours during the day. I always used to think that, say at Hotstar, that all our the soap opera daytime watching was not restricted to peak hours. Because then I realized, sure, the television at home is monopolized by the rest of the family. So why are women, or who is watching data? I mean, all these soap operas during the day. And then it became very clear to me that phone usage for women is higher during the day when kids are away at school in India and when husband is away, right? And that's a reality. And you don't get that insight unless you understand how tier two, tier three markets work, right? That women would have finished all the work at home, and then at 11:30, 12, and 2 hours before their kids are going to come back, they're going to sit and like catch up on the previous night's show. And which is why 12 to 2 was peak time for me, as far as Saas Bahu shows were concerned in India, right? And see, that insight you only get if you try and understand why is this pattern different? Because if somebody owns their own phone, they should be able to watch it at any time, right? And it should match peak time. But then you realize peak time cricket is going on. Peak time something else is going on, right? So I think this is the big gap. I think we need to learn from the old world in a big way, I think, in the startup ecosystem. The principles of market research and user research have not changed, right? They are pretty much the same. Those theories are still very much relevant. And I think we just need to put our egos aside and sort of jump in.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I've kind of read this book again, I think CEO Factory by somebody who's from
Hindustan Lever.
Hindustan Lever, right? And I really enjoyed it, because I think a lot of that. So I think it'll be interesting to see people from those backgrounds come in and be product managers and, you know, product strategists and so on, rather than the typical sort of consulting types, right? Coming in and doing that. But great. So switching gears, let's talk about, you know, a couple of things I've seen you mention in the past, which is that, you know, the coming of age of product management in India, right? And the maturing and the golden age of product management and so forth. And in particular, I think you were also mentioning that you were surprised as to, while that is a great place to be in compared to, say, 10 years or 15 years ago when we were all getting started in this ecosystem, design has overtaken product, right? And design sensibility. So maybe you can sort of elaborate on both, right? The design bit and how design has come to age, and yet, you know, PM has also come to a nice golden age.
Yeah. So, I mean, on the engineering front, I mean, India has been an engineering superpower for a fairly long time. And, you know, it started out in sort of the services industry, but I think in just pure sort of development and actually being that evolution of working for other people and sort of working to a spec document or a PID written by other people to engineers actually taking ownership of building things and what I call a product engineer, right? Which is an engineer with phenomenal product sense. And I think we've sort of seen that evolution. And I think we are already there, right? We are on that engineering front. I think that maturity has come. It's getting more and more mature, but I think we are already world-class or maybe world-class minus one step there as far as engineering is concerned. But about 10 years back, I used to look at the state of product management and of design and UX. And I always used to feel that I think Indian PMs would over time outpace designers because I wasn't seeing world-class design happen in India. I wasn't seeing the quality of our design be. And it was, of course, of a mix of patterns. It wasn't necessarily due to the designers, but essentially, I didn't see designers having a seat at the table 10 years back or even 7-8 years back. What's flipped around completely is that our design quality and the output, the quality of our apps, the quality of our web pages, and just sort of the quality of the user flows is becoming world-class, is already getting there, right? And we can see that with the fact that Indian designers are in demand and sort of are getting now hired by international companies. But I think design outpaced, the growth of Indian designers outpaced. I think suddenly something went off, and I think it's possibly because design can be taught. And because design schools suddenly woke up and said, we have to get people ready for the job market, that the quality of design, the fact that 22-year-olds had portfolios where they had done product deconstructs and they had designed 8 different app interfaces. And, you know, there is no 22-year-old product management aspirant who has done product deconstructs of 20 products. That just doesn't happen, right? Engineers have their GitHub repositories, designers have Behance and Dribbble and everything else, but PMs don't. So, you know, just the fact that people start in product management much later, right, and start developing product sense much later was a factor that I completely missed out in my calculation when I used to think that people, you know, that PMs will outpace designers in India, in the Indian ecosystem. What's happened is designers have outpaced us. Design also has a very clear seat at the table where people have started looking at good design as a moat, as a defensible mechanism against competition, right? That if my product is better designed, then I would win. But what has been heartening, at least in the last year and a half, is that I feel like we are finally entering the golden phase, the golden age of product management globally. And I think it's having a very positive impact on PMing in India. One, I think just the PMs were these people you used to hire. You know, we have to get work done. A project manager hire karlo. And, you know, it was like the PM as a project manager, as somebody who used to get things done and who would run around engineers and designers and get things done. I think that was the take on why people needed a PM. But I think now we're looking at PMs becoming founders. We are looking at founders recognizing that they need good PMs pretty early in the life cycle of their product, even at a very early stage. And we are seeing PMs have an inordinate impact on the product and its growth, right? Like, so now that we have these large, products coming out of India, you know, the Zomato, Swiggy's of the world, the Ola's of the world, the Hotstars of the world, across every domain, we have large enough products which have massive usage, built completely from India, product managed completely from India, designed completely from India. Then I'm finally starting to see that a little bit of maturity coming on the product side, which was much needed. I think there's still a long way to go. Are we world-class yet? I don't think so. I think we are maybe 2 steps below or 3 steps below that. I think design and engineering is still ahead of us, but I think we are entering a really good phase on product management.
Fantastic. So I want to kind of go back a little bit to something that I know you recently started, which is offering your own course on product management. And would love to get your thoughts on you know, what are some of the sort of key critical skills that one should do, right? If you're not from, if you're not already a product manager, right? And you sort of want to either get into product management, or you are a junior product manager or an associate product manager, and you sort of work your way up the ranks. And number one, number two, you know, just this notion of continuous learning, right? Sort of Kaizen, right? How do you do that while you're already working at a job or at a startup, which is worse yet, because you have like 113 things to do every day. So how do you keep current?
So I think my first course was that came out was essentially for existing PMs. And I think the gap there that I realized was that, so if you have 2 years of PMing experience, now you have a seat at the table, you are a PM at a startup, what next? What do you do now that you are a PM, right? Like, how do you think about your own career? How do you think about upskilling yourself? How do you think about growing, right? And that course essentially came out of my own struggles as a PM and the struggles I saw of my entire cohort, right? So the folks who sort of are in the Indian ecosystem, you know, who are product leaders at various companies across the Indian tech ecosystem, I saw all of them sort of struggle and sort of, you know, through a lot of trials and errors, sort of they've reached the places that they have, and, you know, they've all done well for themselves. But the fact is, you know, there was no handholding for a bunch of us. There was no sort of playbook to follow, literally, and which is why I called it playbook, right? Because, like, hey, this is a step-by-step guide to, like, sort of thinking about your career, right? How do you do that sort of grow from a senior PM to a product lead, right? Like, what does it take to actually do that? What does it, how do you contribute to your organization? How do you contribute to your own success? How do you make sure that people who start reporting to you now that you've become a people manager actually succeed? So I think that was one aspect. I think the other thing that I've started very actively doing is also trying to help people get into product management and break into product management, and which is, I think, where your question is, which is how do you develop this product sense? Because there clearly is no curriculum, right? As an engineer, you know, you learn coding at an early stage and early age, and you start solving problems because there are enough and more well-defined problems in the world. And same is true for design, and, you know, design schools have started doing that. At what point in your life do you start thinking about building a product and being a product manager, right? And that gap still exists. So, you know, most people actually make that transition into product management while doing something else. A marketeer moves into product management, or an engineer moves into product management, or a game designer like me moves into product management, right? But again, there is no path there to follow. There is no clearly laid out, like, do step A, B, and C, and then you can sort of become a PM. And I think I'm spending a lot of time there in helping people understand how do you develop a product sense? How do you think about products, right? And then in your current situation, in whatever you're doing, how do you raise your hand and say, hey, I would like to opt in for this role? Because I still feel that the best place to make that transition is at an existing job where you have credibility as an engineer, where you have credibility as a designer. And then say, you know, I'm going to spend 20% of my time doing the PM role, or 30% of my time, and eventually set yourself a 2-quarter target and then flip to being a PM, right? I think it's very difficult to do it from moving from one company to the other, right? I always say that my own transition was more, luck than anything else. I got lucky, right? That I got the right opportunities at the right time. It doesn't play out that way for everyone, right? So I think that those are the things that I've been focusing on, right? Like, both for existing PMs, how to sort of navigate their career and how to think about progress. And two, of sort of how to help people get into product management. And then, of course, there's for all of this, the big thing is, how do you continue to learn, right? And which is, sure, we learn from the day-to-day work. Every time we solve a problem at work, and every time, you know, something fails or something succeeds, we learn from that experience. But I think over and above that, and this is my favorite question to ask people in their interviews, right? I always ask people, like, hey, how do you learn? And, you know, somebody says, I read a lot of blogs. And I'm like, okay, but that's not really learning. You read a lot. That's good. How are you applying this, right? Because I think one of the things people miss about learning is that you can consume a lot of stuff, and that's good. But until unless you're somehow applying it back and completing this loop, it's not really learning, right? So I think what I've always been looking for, and what I've been trying to guide people towards, is that, hey, complete your loop. If you have read a great blog post on growth product management, which part of it are you going to take and apply to your situation and your circumstance? And if you have, show me, like, a real example of, like, hey, I did a course on Reforge on sort of growth product management, and then I took this part and applied it here. Or I read this wonderful blog post on how Google Pay solves for retention and engagement, and then I applied it in my own small healthcare startup, right? And unless this transition happens, and maybe you didn't apply it, but were you able to synthesize all the lessons and write something about it? Were you able to share further? So I think, to me, the greatest growth hack on learning is teaching. The reason I teach is a very super selfish reason. Every time I teach, which means I have to be well prepared, because people will question me and they will hold me accountable for their learning, which means I have to be really good at what I'm teaching, and I have to be able to synthesize all that and then process it and then transfer it to people. So this is the classic Feynman method, right? Like where Richard Feynman very famously said, if I can't turn it into a course for freshmen, then I don't know enough about it. And he very famously said that I can't teach quantum electrodynamics to freshmen. And he had just won a Nobel Prize in that. And he's like, if I can't teach it to freshmen, that means nobody can, because then that means collectively we don't know enough about this subject, right?
Yes.
So to me, that is the loop to crack, right? Which is, whenever I learn something, I try and teach it. If I can teach it successfully, and the success there is, did other people get it? And then did they go further and apply it in their sort of careers and in their sort of situations? Then I know my learning is complete.
Absolutely. I think there's this beautiful quote says that when one teaches, two learn. Obviously, the teacher learns and the student learns, right? So it's the same like the Feynman method. And some of us who are not teaching are podcasting.
Absolutely.
We're learning from smart guys like you.
No, it is exactly that, right? I think operators as teachers is going to be, I'm very bullish on this as a business model, right? Like we had, and one could see the difference. Even if you had gone to engineering school, the profs who were doing industrial consultancy and sponsored research just had a very different take on teaching theoretical subjects than professors who didn't, right? I mean, speaking as somebody who went to engineering school and did chemical engineering, I can clearly tell you that I could make out the difference between the profs who were doing a lot of consulting products and used to run companies of their own on the side. Oh, just phenomenally different in their ability to teach. And I think in our work environment, whether it's design, whether it's engineering, whether it's product management, whether it's business, whether it's marketing, I think we are going to see the rise of operators as teachers. And I think that's a business model I'm super bullish on as well. You know, with the whole cohort-based courses, et cetera, rising, I think the operators as teachers is just a phenomenal thing which is going to happen. Great learning and teaching opportunity.
Wonderful. Hey, Anshupani, great talking to you. Really delighted that you could take some time and spend some time on the Prime Venture Partners podcast. Thanks again for being on the show.
Pleasure being here, Amit, and thanks for having me. Take care.
Listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app for free, and you'll be the first one to know when new episodes are available. Just search for Prime Venture Partners podcast in Apple Podcast, Spotify, Castbox, or however you get your podcasts. Then hit subscribe. And if you have enjoyed the show, we would be really grateful if you leave us a review on Apple Podcast. To read the full transcript, find the link in the show notes.